Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of the Sydney Writers' Festival. You're listening to a Curiosity Lecture recorded live at the 2017 Festival.
Thank all of you for coming, for being here. This is a story about music, and so it richly deserves a musical telling, by which I mean nuanced, relaxed, emphasis in all the right places, and without reading glasses. But we're not going to do that. Because I have so much that I want to tell you that I need to race through this. I'm sorry. I really would like it if we had time for questions at the end, so I'm going to be brutal about this and just roar through this in as ungraceful a fashion as I can muster. And I even have technology to master, so that'll make it even more exciting. So what's going on? 8 years ago in The Hague, the conference of the parties of CITES, the Conventions of International Trade of Endangered Species of Wild Flora and Fauna, it's a UN body, consider new provisions to international treaties that would have required string musicians worldwide to register their bows with their respective governments, essentially as controlled substances. In the US, the Interior Department was given responsibility for the bow registry. I asked officials at Fish and Wildlife, the services who were preparing for the bureaucratic nightmare of listing, over the course of one short summer, millions of bow owners, ranging from professional performers to school children in music programs who owned one of these bows and who might someday want to either sell it or carry it across international borders, which would be illegal to do without a valid government certificate. Yes, the child. This provision would have put fiddle bows under stricter federal scrutiny and control in the US than firearms. Now, obviously, this wasn't because of the danger the bow presents to the human ear. It was a product of the rare wood the bow is made of. It's similar to provisions that CITES has enacted to protect resources like ivory. Now, the bow registration provision was narrowly shelved at the CITES conference. But another provision was passed that heavily restricts international trade in this bow wood, which comes from a tree that grows in Brazil called, in Latin, Cisalpinia echinata, or in Portuguese, Pau Brasil, or in plain English, Pernambuco. All of this reflects a crisis in the environment, clearly. It also highlights a building concern for the arts. This is because, unlike ivory, whose role in a piano is purely ornamental and easy to replicate, Pernambuco is essential to the modern bow, as the bow is essential to the sound of the violin. Without Pernambuco, Western art music, as it's been written and played for 200 years, won't sound the way we're accustomed to hearing it. The music is dependent on the bow, and the bow is dependent on the tree. And the tree is dependent on the environment. Pernambuco is not just native to Brazil, it's endemic, which means it grows nowhere else. I find endemic an interesting word. It's the antonym of epidemic. It means non-spreading, confined to a particular context, a group of people, or a single locale. The locale, in this instance, being the Mata Atlantica, the vast coastal forests that once extended along the Brazilian coast from south of Sao Paulo north to Pernambuco State. Endemic is the partner of dependent. It implies dedication and constraint. To be endemic is something to something or someplace means that it is essential to you and that you can't survive without it. With some rhetorical license, we can say that European art music from the Romantic period on, involving stringed instruments, is another species endemic to the Atlantic forests of Brazil. Now, the bow is one of the earliest and most ubiquitous of musical instruments. I call it an instrument because it is one. It resonates, it produces sound. Yet though numerically it dominates the orchestra, it never appears on the program for the simple reason that to play the bow, you generally must employ another instrument, of which there are several good options available. I think that's Rostropovich. The way that were demonstrated by most of those previous photos isn't the only way to do it. In some cultures, bows are still played by themselves. In recent years, I've hung out a bit with the Seri or Concaic peoples of the Sonoran deserts of Mexico. I was there studying their language. I'll have a lecture about that language. There's a panel on the, that coming up on Sunday. They're also very interesting musically. They're a tribe of only several hundred semi-nomads in the deserts, and they've by the Gulf of California, and they play their bows by setting them on a gourd and plucking them, which is what this gentleman's doing in the foreground here. They also have a method where they play the bow by lying on their backs and clenching the bow in their teeth. Only recently have they come up with a strategy that we find more familiar. Note that the Concaic culture, the bow can be played pizzicato or played with a fiddle. In Western culture, it's the opposite. The fiddle can be played pizzicato or played with a bow. Now, many players say that most of the quality of their sound comes from their bow. And even those who dispute that praise do so with faint damnation. Cellist Heinrich Schiff told me backstage in Vienna one night, "Well, there are those who say it's 50% of the sound, I don't know. Sometimes you depend on the cello, sometimes you depend on the bow." This is a fellow whose backup cello is a Stradivarius. The byword recited to violin students is that it is better to have a mediocre violin and a fine bow than to have a mediocre bow and a fine violin. In the 17th century, the bow was known as the soul of the violin. Giovanni Battista Viotti, the Italian virtuoso of the late 18th century, who is considered the father of modern violin technique, said, "Le violon, c'est la chair." The violin, it's the bow. So the bow we're talking about is what we call a modern bow, a type invented in the late 1780s in Paris, which is significantly different from bows that were used previously, for instance, in Baroque music. The Baroque period coincides with the golden age of violin making in Venice and Cremona and Brescia, elsewhere in Italy. The invention of the modern bow in Paris happens about 100 years after that golden age for instruments, in the pre-dawn of the Romantic era. And what happened to music during that 100 years is an important part of our story, because the music changed dramatically in style and in meaning. And let me try to paint this transition in some rough, very broad strokes. European art music began the 18th century as a devotional art, by which I mean that it was considered valuable to the degree that it illuminated religious or philosophical or narrative themes. Song was considered the highest art music because the words tied music's aesthetic motifs to expressible ideas. It had utility. Instrumental music had no such utility and was considered relatively trivial, if not suspect. Fast forward to 1810, when E.T.A. Hoffman's review of the Beethoven Fifth Symphony, purple prose. I'm not the only one capable of purple prose. E.T.A. Hoffman's review of the Beethoven Fifth Symphony fired the starting pistol, in some people's estimation, for the romantic era of musical aesthetics. By now, instrumental music reigns supreme, precisely because it has no outward utility. Musical aesthetics has been turned on its head. in what had been deemed empty noise is now declared sublime. And music is seen as pure art whose virtue and power lie in its innate structures, not in its ability to expound or adorn some outward notion. In the words of Karl Dahlhaus, music has gone from being a tool of religious observance to being a religion in itself. Musicologists have explained this shift through a sort of theory of trickle-down aesthetics, where music responds to philosophical trends of the era, especially to Immanuel Kant's reformation of the whole notion of beauty. In his third critique, Kant divided beauty into two types. Accessory beauty, that is, beauty that derives its worth from being accessory to a purpose, and free beauty, abstract beauty that has no and needs no utility, that is beautiful in and of itself. Kant held free beauty to be of the highest sort. Now, other musicologists note that the musical innovations of the time didn't just filter down from the philosophical heights. It was also about a product of more earthly things, like musical practice and new technologies, advances in instrument making that make the practice possible. Things like the BAM system of woodwinds and the metal piano frame. As instrumental music rose to prominence, refinements of tone and playing assumed new importance. After all, we're no longer searching for God in the lyrics. We're searching for God in the qualities of individual tones and the structural intricacies of expressive passages. You may think I'm also going to give a lecture on castanets for the way I'm playing with this wrapped cough drop, but I've got to try this, excuse me. And accomplishing this new language required new tools. The greatest of these was the modern violin bow, a tool that was so expressly tuned to the music's demands and whose capabilities so determined the music to follow that it became inextricably bound with the shape of the music itself. For this reason, many classical violinists consider the father of their art to be not Stradivari or Guarneri, but an illiterate former clockmaker turned bowmaker living in Paris in the 1780s and 90s named François-Xavier Tort. Now, F.X. Tort was listening to the frustrations of musicians who came through his shop on Rue des Écoles, especially, it's thought, to Giovanni Viotti, who was in Paris to play with the Concert Spirituel. Tort began aggregating a number of innovations that were floating around and adding a few of his own to come up with a new model bow. His atelier was up in this building, second in from the corner, second floor to the top. That's all a department store now. The model that Tort devised was a radical departure from the Baroque bow. It was sway back, not straight or convex. Its shape was achieved by heating the stick over a flame, not carving it into a curve. Its frog drew the hair tight, not with the old wire or leather thong, but by means of a screw mechanism, and the hair was held flat with a metal ferrule. Because of the concave shape, the hair had to be held off the stick with a higher tip than the old Baroque bow, swan tip or pike's head. Here's a pike's head. And to counteract the extra weight of that tip and keep the bow in balance, pearl, gold, silver, silk adornments were added to the frog end of the bow that seemed ornamental and were indeed beautiful, but which the bow maker could add or omit to calibrate the balance of the stick. Excuse me. Tort carefully worked out the taper of the stick and formulated its curve and gave us the bow that we still use without significant alteration today. All of this work was to maximize two things: a more intense and carrying tone, suitable for the larger performance halls of an increasingly democratic culture, and also the dexterity the bow needed to accomplish the new music. The old Baroque bow had excelled at what Leopold Mozart described as the small, although scarcely noticeable softness at the beginning and at the end of notes, which touched each other, as it's been described, like pearls on a string. I gave that description to my cello instructor one day, and she said, "Pearls on a string, yes, but they must be freshwater pearls." So there are endless refinements. The new bow was capable of a more powerful bow stroke, the coup d'archet, the sharp attack that Viotti pioneered, along with the seamless legato and the sustained crescendo that characterized new composing. For all of this, material mattered as much as design. And this is where the pastimes of F.X. Tort had their indelible effect on Western culture. Tort liked the fish. He liked to fish every afternoon. He kept his fishing tackle in his atelier. You can see some nets in the background. This is the only actual engraving of Tort's atelier. And every chance he got, he went down to the docks to the boat to go fishing on the Seine. And this frequent commute took him past stacks of wood being imported for use one purpose or another, and he would pick up samples to experiment on. In this trial and error way, he settled on a wood that was ideal for his purposes. In fact, as it turns out, in its resonance, its sound-producing capacity, and its agility, its springiness, and its fidelity, its ability to hold a shape, Pernambuco is unmatched. Bowmakers have spent centuries now searching for a substitute. Anybody who's tempted to run next door, you're forgiven. So, most recently, companies have been developing synthetic bows for carbon fiber, but nothing has been found, natural or synthetic, that can replicate the qualities of Pernambuco. The wood was from the New World, from Brazil. All the other materials used in the bow are equally far flung. The tip is mammoth ivory from Siberia. The silk and the horsehair is from China on my bow. The ebony is from Indonesia, the shellac from Madagascar, the silver from Argentina, the steel from Pittsburgh, and the pearl from Monterey. And the stick, my bow, as in other fine performance bows, is from Brazil. The bow is not like the violin, on which ebony is used for fingerboards and pegs, but whose essential sounding materials, spruce, pine, and maple, were regional and often so local that the old Italian makers might cut down the tree themselves. Whenever you listen to even a single note performed on a violin, viola, or cello, you're hearing the clash of two economic systems colliding, because a paragon of localism is being played with an early emblem of world trade. Pernambuco is particularly important in the history of global trade. In the 1500s and 1600s, the kings of France, Portugal, England, Spain, and the Netherlands were furiously waging battles and negotiating and breaking treaties related to the Brazil trade and the Pernambuco concession. The merchants of the French port town of Rouen funded their own civic armada to battle Spain and Portugal for Pernambuco. In 1550, the citizens of Rouen hosted a spectacle for a visiting King Henry II to lobby for his diplomatic support in their private Pernambuco wars, and as part of this spectacle, the populations of two full tribal villages were imported from Brazil to fight a mock aboriginal battle on the banks of the Seine. Memorials to the trade abound in European architecture. I love this battle. This is from a contemporary mural that was done, and it's just extraordinary in its details. Memorials to the trade abound in European architecture, portraying tree harvesting and shiploading in Brazil. Some like these reliefs carved from Pernambuco. In Brazil, native populations were enslaved into the Pernambuco harvest, and when their ranks were decimated, African slaves were imported. For centuries, Pernambuco was Brazil's main export. Pau Brazil wasn't named for the country. The country was named for the wood. Pau Brazil means fire red wood. And that's the reason for all of this, red. The same rosins that make Pernambuco so indispensable to the bow craft recommended it to the dye trade. Pernambuco was the source for red dye used for clerical vestments and royal robes, and later for a whole range of European textiles. At the time that F.X. Tort was looking around for the right wood for a violin bow, 168 acres of downtown Paris were piled high with Pernambuco logs. Tort's other lasting legacy, along with the bow, was the profession of the bowmaker, which has come down unchanged to the current day through generations of makers: Dodd, Sartori, Picot, Bouillon, Voisin, Hill, Kittel, Henry, up to now, when a renaissance of bowmaking since 1970 has brought us some of the finest bows and best bowmakers ever known. That renaissance flourished until an afternoon in 1999, when a group of French bowmakers were summoned to a Montparnasse cafe to hear the news from a former tortoiseshell maker that their indispensable resource was endangered, that CITES was considering outlawing its international trade, and that the only way to save their profession was to take responsibility for saving the tree. I've spent a decade following, or now 15 years, I think. This is in Markneukirchen in Germany. I've been in these ateliers, and they look exactly the same now, with the same machines, just with the leather belts changed as they looked in the late 1800s. And that's me with even less hair. So I've spent over a decade following the effort of the bowmakers to rescue the Pernambuco tree. The rescue required, first of all, some fundamental reflection and reform. Most harvesting of Pernambuco had already been illegal in Brazil, and the bowmakers were in a see-no-evil relationship with black marketeers and desperado wood dealers. Then, and now, Pernambuco stocks are smuggled with cocaine across borders, the provenance of a lot of fine violin bows follows the provenance of illicit drugs. People are murdered in the forest, either trying to pursue the wood trade or stop it every year. But the tree isn't being wiped out one by one by wood dealers. It's the victim of much larger social and economic forces. The Mata Atlantica, the forests, are being decimated for development to create fields for cattle and soybeans and for the enormous eucalyptus reserves that feed the world's largest paper pulp mills at Aracruz. If you've been in coastal Bahia, you know that you can drive for hours past the regimented rows of eucalyptus, a species touted as a renewable resource. To make room for renewable products, in vogue as eco-friendly, square miles of old-growth forest are being mowed down. A clearing method popular when I was coming through that territory was to pull up these house-size tractors, park them a mile apart, connect them with chains, and drive. The bowmakers have instigated new laws in Brazil protecting the tree. And they've conducted a lot of basic research on a tree about which no one even knew how many species and varieties there were. The group has worked with landless peasant movement to make the tree valuable as a living tree, not just after it's been cut down. Pernambuco is now providing overstory for shade-loving cacao plants. Cacao is the source of chocolate, and this means that the ingestion of chocolate and the preservation of classical music are intimately intertwined, if that helps the conscience at all. American and European bowmakers have declared a moratorium on new stocks of wood and are consolidating existing stocks to keep the trade going until the tree's fortunes can reverse. Thousands of Pernambuco trees have been planted on plantations in hopes that in 30 years they can begin to provide a supply, though it's looking as though farm trees won't produce bow quality wood. The wood that comes from trees that have grown slowly, struggling to find light in the dense shades under deep forest canopy, is required. It's amazing to think about it, that the sound of an orchestra may directly reflect the quality of shade in a rainforest. That's a cautionary thought. Because if we can discern the shade in the forest in a passage of music, can we also hear the slavery or poverty that produced the wood? Do we see in Pernambuco, as Charles Dickens said he could see in Mahogany, in the depth of its grain, through all of its polish, the hue of the wretched slave? A growing movement in economics says yes. A concept called chain of value would connect those who profit from a product with the social, economic, and environmental conditions existing where that product came from. It insists that the landless peasant must be taken into consideration by the CEO of Hershey's or Archer's Daniel Midland. The stewardship displayed by the bow makers towards their source materials has made them models for corporations trying to grapple with their own negative externalities, as it's called. Companies on the economy's cutting edge are turning to the last of the old guild crafts for lessons in responsibility, which leads us to a question of craftsmanship. This is the part of this story, which I've been working on for a possible book, that interests me perhaps the most. And in closing the talk, I'd like to say a bit about it. The relationship of people to work is changing dramatically and rapidly in our e-commerce, post-industrial, digital age, and putting into play the question of what does work mean. Torch descendants represent the very old way. Along with other instrument makers, the bow makers are the last craftsmen, the last people making something non-ornamental by hand from beginning to end in a manner passed down from master to apprentice, not out of vanity or nostalgia, but because that's the best and most efficient way to make it. They are the last people making things the way everything used to be made, and the way they work holds lessons for us. In our age, when the ideal worker is held to be someone who is adaptable to many chores and isn't a specialist limited to one way of doing things, what do we make of the craftsperson's lifelong commitment to refining a single set of skills? And what about the soul of craft, repetition? Why is it so exalted in craft when repetition is the soul of dreaded drudgery in industrial work? Repetition, as exaltation, shows up very few places in human experience, basically music, sex, and prayer. Is what we find missing in modern work the idea of work as prayer? It seems that work, since about the time of Tort, has gone from being a religion itself, imbued with moral qualities, to being a tool in the observance of those other religions, profit and convenience. We live today in an epidemic culture where people and societies and economies observe no boundaries and progress is conflated with freedom. Every day that epidemic culture is crashing into the heretical notion of endemicness, the notion that there's value in dedicated skills, value in environmental dependency. Everywhere we hear the clash of competing economies as digital onslaught disrupts the old notions and raises new questions, whether lifelong commitment is something of value, whether the transmission of skills requires a physical, personal apprenticeship in a shop or a classroom, whether environments like newsrooms or libraries or classrooms are essential habitats, or whether, on the other hand, it can all be done by algorithm. Addressing these questions requires that we reopen Immanuel Kant's old question. What are the connections between beauty and outward things? Does beauty reflect in any manner the way it was treated, created? Is there some quality in music endemic to the pain and dedication of the musician? Answering yes puts us at odds with the culture. Yet the Pernambuco story offers a counter-narrative. It's a parable. It asserts a modern heresy that the qualities of the tree, struggling slowly along in the forest, cannot be replicated artificially and en masse. It's a narrative about the value of dedicated work, the virtue of work that shapes the worker. After all, if a Pernambuco substitute had been found, if the bow makers could possibly have done without the wood they had exploited, if the music wasn't dependent on the tree, the forest would not have been saved. Thank you, and we may have a couple of minutes left for any questions.
Thank you so much, Russ. Yes, we do have about 5 minutes for questions, if there are any.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. I've just been sitting here going off on my own thoughts about just about everything you've said. It's just a rich and deep topic. I just wondered, has any forest been saved?
Yeah. Yes. Partly because efforts of the bow makers have attracted a lot of bureaucratic weight within Brazil. Brazil's a hard political environment to mount something like a species preservation, partly because, unfortunately, there's a lot of corruption there. For instance, the environmental minister in charge of forest products was arrested for wood trafficking a few years ago and continued to run his ministry from jail. When I was in Bahia, there was you could be arrested for transporting wood without a permit. You could also be arrested for having a permit to transport wood, because having a government permit was considered prima facie evidence of criminal collusion. So there's that. At the same time, in Brazil, they have laws, and the bow efforts are part of this, that demand that NGOs coming in to do work like the bow makers are doing have to consider social considerations along with environmental considerations, which has meant the bow makers have to deal with the landless peasants movement. So there's also a legal substructure for doing a lot of good things, individual trees and whole swatches of forest have been saved by new laws on the books, but also by a new vigilance and on the part of the government. Yep.
That's right. Is it possible to harvest from the trees without killing the trees?
No. Unfortunately, it is possible, and this is thanks to the bow makers again, to test the tree to see if the wood is appropriate wood before cutting it down. I mean, the old method was just cut it down and see. But it used to take, I think the formula was 18 to 20 tons of raw Pernambuco log to produce a single bow. It's not efficient. That was in the Victorian era. These days, because they don't have a super abundance of wood, and don't take it for granted, and have worked on their methods, it's much more efficient. And in fact, the wood that isn't usable for the fine bows goes to student bows that you buy in, you know, the local violin shop. But even with that efficiency, there are a lot of trees that get cut down, and don't produce good wood. And it's a tragedy because these trees grow not in groves, but in solitary places around the forest. And if you cut out one or two, you disrupt the network that allows them to reproduce. Back.
Given that the trees that are cut down are of a required size, mm-hmm. how many bows would you get? We'll talk about violin bows, say. How many violin bows could you make from one of those trees?
And it depends on the tree, and it depends on the grade of violin bow that you're getting, but you may probably get a couple hundred out of a tree. And so the wood is usually shipped to Europe. A lot comes to the States. China is the big unknown these days because they're not signers to the treaties, and because a lot of the smuggling over the Andes goes directly to China, where a lot of new bows come from. So and also with that comes a lot of inefficiency. I mean, there's tragedies of trees being cut down and then on the ground cut into lengths that are just several millimeters too short for bows, and then a whole tree goes, I'm sorry, I'm dismaying somebody in the front here who's having her night ruined by my descriptions. But yeah, there's, so anyway, the European and American and South American bow makers have declared a moratorium on new wood. And are using existing stocks, which has been tremendously helpful. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How does playing using the modern bow to play on the violin? What sort of sound qualities does it create as compared using the Baroque bow? And to follow up on that question. How does that, those two, modern bow and the Baroque bow fits in with the Kantian notions of free beauty versus accessory beauty?
Well, I think that both bows could be connected with Kantian free beauty. It's just that in the Baroque period, the emphasis was not on the refinements of tone that later came in the Romantic era. There was an extra emphasis on subtleties of tone. Not that Baroque music is played with a deaf ear at all, but the emphasis in the composition of the music was on in other areas, and often on song with the music played by a bow as accompaniment to lyrics. So, in that way, the concentration on instrumental music alone that grew over the course of the 1700s and then over the continuing through the 1800s and the Romantic period represented a move away from music that was in service of religion or in service of entertainment. And your first question was just the difference between the bows. Both bows produce beautiful music, and you hear a lot of Baroque music played on the modern bow. But it's almost impossible to get a top performance of a Romantic era, challenging Romantic era composition with a Baroque bow. It doesn't have a sharp attack. It doesn't have the volume, and it doesn't have the legato. It doesn't. It can't sustain the imperceptible connection between. Between notes that the later bow allows. Yeah.
That will be the last question. Yes. Yeah. Thank you.
Really quick question. Have the musicians jumped on board as well as the bow
yes.
makers?
Yes. Yeah. I wish they had jumped on board more, but. The reason I was interviewing Heinrich Schiff backstage in Vienna was that he does performances to raise money for the bow, and whole orchestras in the U.S. are and in Europe are having performances to raise money, and devoting a part of their proceeds, and a lot of just violin shops that sell violins and bows and every other thing contribute a percentage of their proceeds. So behind the scenes, and often unknown to the people buying tickets in concert halls, there's a big awareness among musicians that they need this as much as the bow makers do too.
All right, thank you very much, Russ. Let's thank Russ again.